Welcome to this Ubula audio presentation of A Tramp Abroad by Mark Twain. Volume 13, Chapter 35, Swindling the Coroner. A great and priceless thing is a new interest. How it takes possession of a man, how it clings to him, how it rides him. I strode onward from the Schwarenbach hostelry, a changed man. A reorganized personality. I walked into a new world. I saw with new eyes. I'd been looking aloft at the giant snow peaks only as things to be worshipped for their grandeur and magnitude and their unspeakable grace of form. I looked up at them now as also things to be conquered and climbed. My sense of their grandeur and their noble beauty was neither lost nor impaired. I had gained a new interest in the mountains without losing the old ones. I followed the steep lines up inch by inch with my eye, and noted the possibility or impossibility of following them with my feet. When I saw a shining helmet of ice projecting above the clouds, I tried to imagine I saw files of black specks toiling up it, roped together with a gossamer thread. We skirted the lonely little lake called Daubensee, and presently passed close by a glacier on the right, a thing like a great river frozen solid in its flow and broken square off like a wall at its mouth. I'd never been so near a glacier before. Here we came upon a new board shanty and found some men engaged in building a stone house, so the Schwarenbach was soon to have a rival. We bought a bottle or so of beer here. At any rate, they called it beer, but I knew by the price that it had to be dissolved jewelry, and I perceived by the taste that dissolved jewelry was not good stuff to drink. We were surrounded by a hideous desolation. We stepped forward to a sort of jumping-off place, and were confronted by a startling contrast. We seemed to look down into a fairyland. 2,000 or 3,000 feet below us was a green, bright level, with a pretty town in its midst, and a silvery stream winding along the meadows. The charming spot was walled in on all sides by gigantic precipices clothed with pine, and over the pines, out of the softened distances, rose the snowy domes and peaks of the Monte Rosa region. How exquisitely green and beautiful that little valley down there was. The distance was not great enough to obliterate details, and it only made them little and mellow and dainty, like landscapes and towns seen through the wrong end of a spyglass. Right under us a narrow ledge rose up out of the valley, with a green, slanting, bench-topped shape, and grouped upon this green baize bench were a lot of black and white sheep, which looked merely like oversized worms. The bench seemed lifted well up into our neighborhood, but that was a deception. It was a long way down. We began our descent now by the most remarkable road I have ever seen. It wound its corkscrew curves down the face of the colossal precipice, a narrow way with always the solid rock at one elbow and perpendicular nothingness at the other. We met an everlasting procession of guides and porters and mules, litters and tourists climbing up this steep and muddy path, and there was no room to spare when you had to pass a tolerably fat mule. I always took the inside when I heard or saw the mule coming and flattened myself against the wall. I preferred the inside, of course, but I should have had to take it anyhow because the mules preferred the outside. A mule's preference, on a precipice, is a thing to be respected. Well, his choice is always the outside. His life is mostly devoted to carrying bulky panniers and packages which rest against his body. Therefore, he is habituated to taking the outside edge of the mountain to keep his bundles from rubbing against the rocks or banks on the other. When he goes into the passenger business, he absurdly clings to his old habit and keeps one leg of his passenger always dangling over the great deeps of the lower world while the passenger's heart is in the highlands, so to speak. More than once I saw a mule's hind foot cave over the outer edge and send earth and rubbish into the bottom abyss, and I noticed that upon those occasions the rider, whether male or female, looked tolerably unwell. There was only one place where an 18-inch breadth of light masonry had been added to the verge of the path, and as there was a very sharp turn there, a panel of fencing had been set up there at some point as protection. This panel was old and gray and feeble, and by the light masonry had been loosened by recent rains. A young American girl came along on a mule, and in making the turn, the mule's hind foot caved in all the loose masonry and one of the fence posts overboard. The mule gave a violent lurch inboard to save himself and succeeded in the effort, but the girl turned as white as the snows of Mont Blanc for a moment. The path was simply a groove cut into the face of the precipice. There was a 4-foot breadth of solid rock under the traveler, and a 4-foot breadth of solid rock just above his head, like the roof of a narrow porch. He could look out from this gallery and see a sheer, summitless and bottomless wall of rock before him, across a gorge or a biscuit's toss in width. But he could not see the bottom of his own precipice unless he lay down and projected his nose over the edge. I did not do this, because I did not wish to soil my clothes. Every few hundred yards, at particularly bad places, one came across a panel or so of plank fencing. But they were always old and weak, and they generally leaned out over the chasm and did not make any rash promises to hold up people who might need support. There was one of these panels which had only its upper board left. A pedestrianizing English youth came tearing down the path and was seized with an impulse to look over the precipice. And without an instant's thought, he threw his weight upon that crazy board. It bent outward a foot. I never made a gasp before that came so near to suffocating me. The English youth's face simply showed a lively purpose, but nothing more. He went swinging along valleyward, as if he did not know he had just swindled a coroner by the closest kind of shave. The Alpine litter is sometimes like a cushioned box made fast between the middle of two long poles, and sometimes it is a chair with a back to it and a support for the feet. It is carried by relays of strong porters. The motion is easier than that of any other conveyance. We met a few men and a great many ladies in litters. It seemed to me that most of the ladies looked pale and nauseated. Their general aspect gave me the idea that they were patiently enduring a horrible suffering. As a rule, they looked at their laps and left the scenery to take care of itself. But the most frightened creature I saw was a horse that overtook us. Poor fellow! He had been born and reared in the grassy levels of the Kandersteg Valley, and had never seen anything like this hideous place before. Every few steps he would stop short, glance wildly out from the dizzying height, and then spread his red nostrils wide and pant as violently as if he had been running a race. And all the while he quaked from head to heel as if with palsy. He was a handsome fellow, and he made a fine statuesque picture of terror. But it was pitiful to see him suffer so. This dreadful path had had its tragedy. Baedeker, with his customary over-terseness, begins and ends the tale thus. Quote, "The descent on horseback should be avoided. In 1861, a Contessa de Herlincourt fell from her saddle over the precipice and was killed on the spot." Unquote. We looked over the precipice there and saw the monument which commemorates the event. It stands at the bottom of the gorge, in a place which has been hollowed out of the rocks to protect it from the torrent and the storms. Our old guide never spoke but when spoken to, and then limited himself to a syllable or two. But when we asked him about this tragedy, he showed a strong interest in the matter. He said the Contessa was very pretty and very young and hardly out of her girlhood. In fact, she was newly married, and was on her bridal tour. The young husband was riding a little in advance, and one guide was leading the husband's horse, and another was leading the bride's. The old man said this, "The guide which was leading the husband's horse happened to glance back, and there was that poor young thing sitting up, staring out over the precipice, and her face began to bend downward a little.
and she put up her two hands slowly and met it, so, and put them flat against her eyes, so. And then she sank out of the saddle with a sharp shriek, and one caught only the flash of a dress, and it was all over. And then, after a pause, yes, the guide saw these things. Yes, he saw them all. He saw them all, just as I have told you.
And after another pause,
yes, he saw them all. My God, that was me. I was the guide.
This had been the one event of the old man's life, so one may be sure he had forgotten no detail connected with it. We listened to all he had to say about what was done and what happened, and what was said after the sorrowful occurrence and the painful story it was. As we wound down toward the valley, we were about on the last spiral of the corkscrew, and Harris's hat blew over the last remaining bit of precipice, a small cliff about 100 or 150 feet high, and it sailed downward toward a steep slant composed of rough chips and fragments which the weather had flaked away from the precipices. We went leisurely down there, expecting to find it without any trouble, but we made a mistake. We hunted for it for a couple of hours, not because the old straw hat was valuable, but out of curiosity to find out how such a thing could manage to conceal itself on open ground where there was nothing left for it to hide behind. When one is reading in bed and lays his paper knife down, he cannot find it again if it is smaller than a saber. That hat was as stubborn as any paper knife could have been, and we finally had to give up. We found a fragment that must belong to an opera glass, and by digging around it and turning over the rocks, we gradually collected all the lenses and cylinders and the various odds and ends that go into making a complete opera glass. We afterwards had the thing reconstructed, and the owner can have his adventurous lost property by submitting proof and paying cost of rehabilitation. We had hopes of finding the owner there, distributed amongst the rocks, for it would have been an elegant paragraph. But we were disappointed. Still, we were far from being disheartened, for there was a considerable area which we had not thoroughly searched. We were satisfied that body was there somewhere, so we resolved to wait over a day at Luke and come back and get it. Then we sat down to polish off the perspiration and arrange about what we would do with him when we got him. Harris was for contributing him to the British Museum, but I was for mailing him to his widow. That was the difference between Harris and me. Harris is all for display, but I am for the simple right, even though I lose money by it. Harris argued in favor of a proposition against mine. I argued in favor of mine and against his. The discussion warmed into a dispute, and the dispute warmed into a quarrel. I finally said very decidedly, "My mind is made up. He goes to the widow." And Harris answered sharply, "And my mind is made up. He goes to the museum." I said calmly, "The museum may whistle when it gets him." Harris retorted, "The widow may save herself the trouble of whistling, for I will see that she never gets him." After some angry bantering of epithets, I said, "Seems to me that you are taking on a good many airs about these remains. I don't quite see what you've got to say about them."
I got all to say about them. They'd never have been thought of if I hadn't found an air opera glass. Quartz belongs to me. I'll do with it as I please."
I was the leader of the expedition, and all discoveries achieved by it naturally belonged to me. I was entitled to these remains, and could have enforced my right. But rather than have bad blood about the matter, I said we would toss for them. I threw heads and won, but it was a barren victory, for although we spent all the next day searching, we never found a bone. I cannot imagine what could have ever become of that fellow. The town in the valley is called Luke, or Lukerbad. We pointed our course toward it, down a verdant slope which was adorned with fringed gentians and other flowers, and presently entered the narrow valleys of the outskirts and waded toward the middle of the town through liquid fertilizer. They ought to either pave that village or organize a ferry. Harris's body was simply a chamois pasture. His person was populous with the little hungry pests. His skin, when he stripped, was splotched like a scarlet fever patient's. So when we were about to enter one of the Lucrebon inns and he noticed its sign, Chamois Hotel, he refused to stop there. He said that the chamois were plentiful enough without hunting up hotels where they made a specialty of it. I was indifferent, for the chamois is a creature that will neither bite me nor abide with me. But to calm Harris, we went to the Hotel des Alpes. At the table d'hôte, we had this for an incident. A very grave man. In fact, his gravity amounted to solemnity, and almost to austerity, sat opposite us, and he was tight, but doing his best to appear sober. He took up a corked bottle of wine, tilted it over his glass a while, then set it out of the way with a contented look, and went on with his dinner. Presently he put his glass to his mouth and, of course, found it empty. He looked puzzled, and glanced furtively and suspiciously out of the corner of his eye at a benignant and unconscious old lady who sat to his right. He shook his head, as much to say, "Nah, she couldn't have done it." He tilted the corked bottle over his glass again, meantime searching around with his watery eye to see if anybody was watching him. He ate a few mouthfuls, raised his glass to his lips, and of course it was empty. He bent an injured and accusing sidewise glance upon the unconscious old lady, which was a study to see. She went on eating and gave no sign. He took up his glass and his bottle, with a wise private nod of his head, and set them gravely on the left-hand side of his plate, poured himself another imaginary drink, went to work with his knife and fork once more, presently lifted his glass with good confidence, and found it empty as usual. This was almost a petrifying surprise to him. He straightened himself up in his chair and deliberately and sorrowfully inspected the busy old ladies at his elbows, first one, then the other. At last he softly pushed his plate away, set his glass directly in front of him, held on to it with his left hand, and proceeded to pour with his right. This time he observed that nothing came out. He turned the bottle clear upside down, still nothing, and a plaintive look came into his face, and he said as if to himself,
"Eich, they got it all."
Then he set the bottle down resignedly and took the rest of his dinner dry. It was at that table d'hôte, too, that I had under inspection the largest lady I have ever seen in private life. She was over 7 feet tall and magnificently proportioned. What had first called my attention to her was my stepping on an outlying flange of her foot and hearing from upward the ceiling a deep,
"Pardon, monsieur, but you encroach."
That was when we were coming through the hall and the place was dim, and I could only see her vaguely. The thing which called my attention to her the second time was that at a table beyond ours were two very pretty girls, and this great lady came in and sat down between them and me and blotted out my view of them. She had a handsome face, and she was finely formed, perfectly formed, I should say. But she made everybody around her look trivial and commonplace. Ladies near her looked like children, and the men about her looked mean. They looked like failures, and they looked as if they felt so, too. She sat with her back to us, and I never saw such a back in my life. I would so have liked to see the moon rise over it. The whole congregation waited, under one pretext or another, till she finished her dinner and went out. They wanted to see her at full altitude, and they found it worth tarrying for. She filled one's ideas of what an empress ought to be, when she rose up in her unapproachable grandeur and moved superbly out of the place. We were not at Luke in time to see her at her heaviest weight. She had suffered from corpulence and had come there to get rid of her extra flesh in the baths. 5 weeks of soaking, 5 uninterrupted hours of it every day, had accomplished her purpose and reduced her to the right proportions. Those baths removed fat, and also skin diseases. The patients remained in the great tanks for hours at a time. 12 gentlemen and ladies occupy a tank together and amuse themselves with rompings and various games. They have floating desks and tables, and they read or lunch or play chess in water that is breast deep. The tourist can step in and view this novel spectacle if he chooses. There is a poor box, and he will have to contribute. There are several of these big bathing houses, and you can always tell when you are near one of them by the romping noises and shouts of laughter that proceed from it. The water is running water and changes all the time, else a patient with ringworm might take the bath with only partial success, since while he was ridding himself of the ringworm, he might catch the itch. Next morning, we wandered up the green valley, leisurely, with the curving walls of those bare and stupendous precipices rising into the clouds before us. I had never seen a clean, bare precipice stretching up 5,000 feet above me before, and I shall never expect to see one again. They exist, perhaps, but not in places where one can easily get to them. This pile of stone, however, is peculiar. From its base to its soaring tops of mighty towers, all its lines and details vaguely suggest human architecture. There are rudimentary bow windows, cortices, chimneys, demarcations of stories, etc. One could sit and stare up there and study the features and exquisite graces of this grand structure bit by bit and day after day and never weary his interest. The termination toward the town, observed in profile, is the perfection of shape. It comes down out of the clouds in a succession of rounded, colossal, terrace-like projections. A stairway for the gods, at its head, spring several lofty, storm-scarred towers, one after another, with faint films of vapor curling always about them like spectral banners. If there were a king whose realms included the whole world, here would be a place that would be proper for such a monarch. He would only need to hollow it out and put in the electric lights. He could give audience to a nation at a time under its roof. Our search for those remains having failed, we inspected with a glass the dim and distant track of an old-time avalanche that once swept down from some pine-grown summits behind the town and swept away houses and buried people. Then we struck down the road that leads toward the Rhone to see the famous ladders. These perilous things are built against the perpendicular face of a cliff 200 or 300 feet high. The peasants of both sexes were climbing up and down with heavy loads on their backs. I ordered Harris to make the ascent so I could put the thrill and horror of it in my book, and he accomplished the feat successfully through a sub-agent for 3 francs, which I paid. Makes me shudder yet when I think of what I felt when I was clinging there between heaven and earth in the person of that proxy. At times, the world swam around me and I could hardly keep from letting go, so dizzying was the appalling danger. Many a person would have given up and descended, but I stuck to my task and would not yield until I had accomplished it. I felt a just pride in my exploit, but I would not have repeated it for the wealth of the world. I shall break my neck yet with some such foolhardy performance, for warnings never seemed to have any lasting effect on me. When the people of the hotel found I had been climbing those crazy ladders, it made me an object of considerable attention. The next morning, early, we drove to the Rhone Valley and took the train for Visp. There we shouldered our knapsacks and things and set out on foot in a tremendous rain, up the winding gorge towards Zermatt. Hour after hour we slopped along by the roaring torrent and under noble lesser Alps, which were clothed in rich velvety green all the way up, and had little atomy Swiss homes perched upon grassy benches along their mist-dimmed heights. The rain continued to pour and the torrent to boom, and we continued to enjoy both. At one spot where this torrent tossed its white mane highest and thundered loudest and lashed the big boulders fiercest, the canton had done itself honor to build the flimsiest wooden bridge that exists in the world. While we were walking over it, along with a party of horsemen, I noticed that even the larger raindrops made it shake. I called Harris's attention to it, and he noticed it too. It seemed to me that if I owned an elephant that was a keepsake and thought a good deal of him, I would think twice before I would ride him over that bridge. We climbed up to the village of St. Nicholas about 4:30 in the afternoon and waded ankle deep through the fertilizer juice. We stopped at a new and nice hotel close to the little church. We stripped and went to bed and sent our clothes down to be baked. And the horde of soaked tourists did the same. That chaos of clothing got mixed in the kitchen, and there were consequences. I did not get back the same drawers I sent down when our things came back up at 6:15. I got a pair on a new plan. They were merely a pair of white, ruffled, cuffed absurdities, hitched together at the top with a narrow band, and they did not quite come down to my knees. They were pretty enough, but they made me feel like two people, and disconnected at that. The man must have been an idiot that got himself up like that, to rough it in the Swiss mountains. The shirt they brought me was shorter than my drawers, and hadn't any sleeves to it. At least it hadn't anything more than what Mr. Darwin would call rudimentary sleeves. These had edging around them, but the bosom was ridiculously plain. The knit silk undershirt they brought me was on a new plan, and was really a sensible thing. It opened behind and had pockets in it to put your shoulder blades in. But they did not seem to fit mine, so I found it, well, a sort of uncomfortable garment. They gave my bobtail coat to somebody else and sent me an ulster suitable for a giraffe. I had to tie my collar on because there was no button behind on that foolish little shirt which I described a while ago. When I was dressed for dinner at 6:30, I was too loose in some places and too tight in others, and altogether I felt slovenly and ill-conditioned. However, the people at the table d'hôte were no better off than I was. They had everybody's clothes but their own. A long stranger recognized his ulster as soon as he saw the tail of it following me in, but nobody claimed my shirt or my drawers, though I described them as well as I was able. I gave them to the chambermaid that night when I went to bed, and she probably found the owner, for my own things were on the chair outside my door the next morning. There was a lovable English clergyman who did not get to the table d'hôte at all. His breeches had turned up missing, and without any equivalent. He said he was not more particular than other people, but he had noticed that a clergyman at table without any breeches was almost surely to excite remark. Chapter 26. The Fiendish Fun of Alp Climbing. We did not oversleep at St. Nicholas. The church bell began to ring at 4:30 in the morning, and for the length of the time it continued to ring, I judged that it takes the Swiss sinner a good while to get the invitation through his head. Most church bells in the world are of poor quality and have harsh and rasping sounds, which upset the temper and produce much sin. But the St. Nicholas bell is a good deal the worst that has ever been contrived yet. And it is peculiarly maddening in its operation. Still, it may have its right and its excuse to exist, for the community is poor and not every citizen can afford a clock. But there cannot be any excuse for any church bells at home, for there is no family in America without a clock, and consequently there is no fair pretext for the usual Sunday medley of dreadful sounds that issues from our steeples. There is much more profanity in America on Sunday than in all the other 6 days of the week put together, and it is of a more bitter and malignant character than the weekday profanity. It is produced by the cracked pot clangor of those cheap church bells. We build our churches almost without regard to cost. We rear an edifice which is an adornment to the town, and we gild it and fresco it and mortgage it and do everything we can think of to perfect it, and then spoil it all by putting a bell on it, which afflicts everybody who hears it, giving some the headache, other St. Vitus's dance, and the rest the blind staggers. An American village at 10 o'clock on a summer Sunday morning is the quietest and peacefulest and holiest thing in nature, but it is a pretty different thing half an hour later. Mr. Poe's poem of the bells stands incomplete to this day, but it is well enough that it is so, for the public reciter or reader who goes around trying to imitate the sounds of the various sorts of bells with his voice would find himself up the stump when he got to the church bell, as Joseph Addison would say. The church is always trying to get other people to reform. Might not be a bad idea to reform itself a little, by way of example. Still clings to one or two other things which were useful once, but which are not useful now, and neither are they ornamental. One is the bell ringing to remind a clock-caked town that it is church time, and another is the reading from the pulpit of a tedious list of notices, which everybody who is interested has already read in the newspaper. The clergyman even reads the hymn through, a relic of an ancient time when hymn books were scarce and costly. But everybody has a hymn book now, and so the public reading is no longer necessary. It is not merely unnecessary, it is generally painful, for the average clergyman could not fire into his congregation with a shotgun and hit a worse reader than himself, unless the weapon scattered shamefully. I'm not meaning to be flippant or irreverent. I'm only meaning to be truthful. The average clergyman in all countries and of all denominations is a very bad reader. One would think he would at least learn how to read the Lord's Prayer, but that's not so. He races through it as if he thought the quicker he got in it, the sooner it would be answered. A person who does not appreciate the exceeding value of pauses and does not know how to measure their duration judiciously cannot render the grand simplicity and dignity of a composition like that effectively. We took a tolerably early breakfast and tromped off toward Zermatt through the reeking lanes of the village, glad to get away from that bell. By and by we had a fine spectacle on our right. It was the wall-like butt end of a huge glacier, which looked down on us from an alpine height which was well up in the blue sky. It was an astonishing amount of ice to be compacted together in such a mass. We ciphered upon it and decided it was not less than several hundred feet from the base of the wall of solid ice to the top of it. Harris believed it was really twice that. We judged that if St. Peter's, St. Paul's, and the Great Pyramid, the Strasbourg Cathedral, and the Capitol of Washington were clustered against the wall, a man sitting on its upper edge could not hang his hat on the top of any one of them without reaching down 300 or 400 feet, a thing which, of course, no man could do. To me, that mighty glacier was very beautiful, and I did not imagine that anybody could find fault with it. But I was mistaken. Harris had been snarling for several days. He was a rabid Protestant, and he was always saying, "In the Protestant cantons, you never see such poverty and dirt and squalor as you do in this Catholic one. You never see the lanes and alleys flowing with foulness. You never see such wretched little sties of houses. You never see an inverted tin turnip on top of a church for a dome. As for a church bell, why, you never hear a church bell at all." All this morning he had been finding fault straight along. First it was with the mud. He said, "It ain't muddy in Protestant cantons when it rains." Then it was with the dogs. "They don't have those lop-eared dogs in the Protestant cantons." Then it was with the roads. "They don't leave the roads to make themselves in a Protestant canton. The people make them, and they make a road that is a road, too." Next it was the goats. "You never see a goat shedding tears in a Protestant canton. A goat there is the cheerfulest object in nature." Next it was the chamois. "You never see a Protestant chamois act like one of these. They take a bite or two and go, but these fellows camp with you and stay." Then it was the guideboards. "In a Protestant canton, you can't get lost if you wanted to, but you never see a guideboard in a Catholic canton." Next, "You never see any flower boxes in the windows here. Never anything but now and then a cat, a torpid one. You take a Protestant canton, windows perfectly lovely with flowers. And as for cats, there's just acres of them. These folks in this canton leave a road to make itself and then fine you 3 francs if you trot over it, as if a horse could trot over such sarcasm of a road." Next, about the goiter.
They talk about goiter. I haven't seen a goiter in this whole canton I couldn't put a hat on.
He had growled at everything, but I judged it would puzzle him to find anything the matter with this majestic glacier. I intimated as much, but he was ready and said with surly discontent,
"You ought to see them in the Protestant cantons."
This irritated me, but I concealed the feeling and asked, "What is the matter with this one?"
"Matter? Why, it ain't in any kind of condition. They never take any care of a glacier here. The moraine has been smelling gravel all around, and it got all dirty."
"They can't help that, man."
"They? You're right, that is. They won't. They could if they wanted to. You never see a speck of dirt on a Protestant glacier. Look at the Rhone Glacier. 15 miles long, 700 feet thick. If this was a Protestant glacier, you wouldn't see it looking like this, I can tell you."
"Well, that is pure nonsense. What would they do with it?"
"They could whitewash it. They always do."
I did not believe a word of this, but rather than have trouble, I just let it go, for it's a waste of breath to argue with a bigot. I even doubted if the Rhone Glacier was in a Protestant canton, but I did not know, so I could not make anything by contradicting a man who would probably put me down at once with manufactured evidence. About 9 miles from St. Nicholas, we crossed a bridge over the raging torrent of the Visp and came to a log strip of flimsy fencing, which was pretending to secure people from tumbling over a perpendicular walk 40 feet high and into the river. 3 children were approaching. One of them, a little girl about 8 years old, was running. When pretty close to us, she stumbled and fell, and her feet shot out under the rail of the fence and for a moment projected over the stream. It gave us a sharp shock, for we thought she was a goner. Sure, for the ground slanted steeply, and to save herself seemed a sheer impossibility. She managed to scramble up and ran by us laughing. We went forward and examined the place and saw the long tracks which her feet had made in the dirt when they darted over the verge. If she had finished her trip, she would have struck some big rocks at the edge of the water, and then the torrent would have snatched her downstream among the half-covered boulders, and she would have been pounded to pulp in 2 minutes. We had come exceedingly near to witnessing her death. And now Harris's contrary nature and inborn selfishness were strikingly manifested. He had no spirit of self-denial. He began straight off and continued for an hour to express his gratitude that the child was not destroyed. I never saw such a man. That was the kind of person he was, just so he was gratified. He never cared anything about anybody else. I had noticed that trait in him over and over again. Often, of course, it was mere heedlessness and mere want of reflection. Doubtless, this may have been the case in most instances, but it was not the less hard to bear on that account. And after all, its bottom, its groundwork, was selfishness. There's no avoiding that conclusion. In the instance under consideration, I did think the indecency of running on in that way might occur to him, but no, the child was saved and he was glad, and that was sufficient. He cared not a straw for my feelings, or my loss of such a literary plum, snatched from my very mouth at the instant it was ready to drop into it. His selfishness was sufficient to place his own gratification in being spared suffering, clear before all concern for me, his friend. Apparently he did not once reflect upon the valuable details which would have fallen like a windfall to me, fishing the child out, witnessing the surprise of the family and the stir the thing would have made among the peasants, a Swiss funeral, roadside monuments. We could have paid for them, have our names mentioned in it. We should have gone into Baedeker and been immortal. I was silent. I was too much hurt to complain. If he could act so and be so heedless and frivolous at such a time and actually seem to glory in it, after all I had done for him, I would have cut off my hand before I would have let him see I was wounded. We were approaching Zermatt. Consequently, we were approaching the renowned Matterhorn. A month before, this mountain had been only a name to us, but latterly we had been moving through a steadily thickening double row of pictures of it, done in oil, water, chromo, wood, steel, copper, crayon, and photography, and so would had at length become a shape to us, a very distinct and decided and familiar one. We were expecting to recognize that mountain whenever or wherever we should run across it, and we were not deceived. The monarch was far away when we first saw him, but there was no such thing as mistaking him. He was the rare peculiarity of standing by himself. He was peculiarly steep, too, and also most oddly shaped. He towers into the sky like a colossal wedge, with the upper third of its blade bent a little to the left. The broad base of this monster wedge is planted upon a grand glacier-paved alpine platform whose elevation is 10,000 feet above sea level. As the wedge itself is some 5,000 feet high, it follows that its apex is about 15,000 feet above sea level. So the whole bulk of this stately piece of rock, this sky-cleaving monolith, is above the line of eternal snow. Yet while all its giant neighbors have the look of being built of solid snow from their waists up, the Matterhorn stands black and naked and forbidding, the year round, and merely powdered or streaked with white in places, for its sides are so steep that even down farther snow cannot stay there. Its strange form in august isolation and its majestic unkinship with its own kind make it, so to speak, the Napoleon of the mountain world. Grand, gloomy, and peculiar is a phrase which fits it as aptly as it fit the great captain. Think of a monument a mile high, standing on a pedestal 2 miles high. This is what the Matterhorn is, a monument. Its office, henceforth for all time, will be to keep watch and ward over the secret resting place of the young Lord Douglas, who in 1865 was precipitated from the summit over a precipice 4,000 feet high. And he was never seen again. No man ever had such a monument as this before. The most imposing of the world's other monuments are but atoms compared to it, and they will perish, and their places will pass from memory. But this will remain. A walk from St. Nicholas to Zermatt is a wonderful experience. Nature is built on a stupendous plan in that region. One marches continually between walls that are piled into the skies, with their upper heights broken into a confusion of sublime shapes that gleam white and cold against the background of blue. And here and there one sees a big glacier displaying its grandeurs on top of a precipice or a graceful cascade leaping and flashing down the green declivities. There is nothing tame or cheap or trivial. It is all magnificent. That short valley is a picture gallery of a notable kind, for it contains no mediocrities, and from end to end the Creator has hung it with his masterpieces. We made Zermatt at 3 p.m, 9 hours out from St. Nicholas. Distance by guidebook, 12 miles. By pedometer, 72. We were in the heart and home of the mountain climbers now, as all visible things testified. The snow peaks did not hold themselves aloof in aristocratic reserve. They nestled close around in a friendly, sociable way. Guides with ropes and axes and other implements of their fearful calling slung about their persons, roosted in a long line upon a stone wall in front of the hotel and waited for customers, sunburnt climbers in mountaineering costumes, and followed by their guides and porters arrived from time to time from breakneck expeditions among the peaks and glaciers of the high Alps. There were male and female tourists on mules that filed by in a continuous procession, hotelward bound from wild adventures which would grow in grandeur every time they were described at the English or American fireside, and at last outgrow the possible itself. We were not dreaming. This was not a make-believe home of the Alp climber, created by our heated imaginations. No, for here was Mr. Girdlestone himself, the famous Englishman who hunts his way to the most formidable alpine peaks without a guide. I was not equal to imagining a Girdlestone. It was all I could do to even realize him while looking straight at him at short range. I would rather face whole Hyde Parks of artillery than the ghastly forms of death which he has faced among the peaks and precipices of mountaineering. There is probably no pleasure equal to the pleasure of climbing a dangerous Alp, but it is a pleasure which is strictly confined to people who can find pleasure in it. I have not jumped to this conclusion. I have traveled to it per gravel train, so to speak. I have thought the thing out and am quite sure I am right. A born climber's appetite for climbing is hard to satisfy. When it comes upon him, he is like a starving man with a feast before him. He may have other business on hand, but it must wait. Mr. Girdlestone had had his usual summer holidays in the Alps and had spent it in his usual way, hunting for unique chances to break his neck. His vacation was over and his luggage packed for England, but all of a sudden a hunger had come upon him to climb the tremendous Weisshorn once more, for he had heard of a new and utterly impossible route up of it. His baggage was unpacked at once, and now he and a friend, laden with knapsacks, ice axes, coils of rope, and canteens of milk, were just setting out. They would spend the night up there somehow, high among the snows, somewhere, and get up at 2 a.m. and finish the enterprise. I had a strong desire to go with them, but forced it down, a feat which Mr. Girdlestone, with all his fortitude, could not do. Even ladies catch the climbing mania and are unable to throw it off. A famous climber of that sex had attempted the Weisshorn a few days before our arrival, and she and her guides had lost their way in a snowstorm high up among the peaks and glaciers, and had been forced to wander around a good while before they could find their way down. When this lady reached the bottom, she had been on her feet 23 hours. Our guides, hired on the Jemmy, were already at Zermatt when we reached there, so there was nothing to interfere with our getting up an adventure whenever we should choose the time and the object. I resolved to devote my first evening in Zermatt to studying up the subject of alpine climbing by way of preparation. I read several books, and here are some of the things I have found out. One's shoes must be strong and heavy, and have pointed hobnails in them. The alpenstock must be of the best wood, for if it should break, loss of life could result. One should carry an axe to cut steps in the ice with on the greater heights. There must be a ladder, for there are steep bits of rock which can be surmounted with this instrument, or this utensil, but could not be surmounted without it. Such an obstruction has compelled the tourist to waste hours hunting another route, when a ladder would have saved him all that trouble. One must have from 150 to 500 feet of strong rope to be used in lowering the party down steep declivities, which are too steep and smooth to be traversed in any other way. One must have a steel hook on another rope, a very useful thing, for when one is ascending and comes to a low bluff, which is yet too high for the ladder, he swings this rope aloft like a lasso, and the hook catches the top of the bluff, and then the tourist climbs the rope, hand over hand, being always particular to try and forget that if the hook gives way, he will never stop falling till he arrives in some part of Switzerland where they are not expecting him. Another important thing, there must be a rope to tie the whole party together with, so that if one falls from a mountain or down a bottomless chasm in a glacier, the others may brace back on the rope and save him. One must have a silk veil to protect their face from snow, sleet, hail, and gale, and colored goggles to protect their eyes from that dangerous enemy, snow blindness. Finally, there must be some porters to carry provisions, wine and scientific instruments, and also blanket bags for the party to sleep in. I closed my readings with a fearful adventure which Mr. Whymper once had on the Matterhorn when he was prowling around alone 5,000 feet above the town of Brail. He was edging his way gingerly around the corner of a precipice where the upper edge of a sharp declivity of ice-glazed snow joined it. This declivity swept down a couple of 100 feet into a gully which curved around and ended at a precipice 800 feet high
and overlooking a glacier. His foot slipped, and he fell. He says, "My knapsack brought my head down first, and I pitched into some rocks about a dozen feet below. They caught something and tumbled me off the edge, head over heels, into the gully. The baton was dashed from my hands, and I whirled downward in a series of bounds, each longer than the last, now over ice, now into rocks, striking my head 4 or 5 times, each time with increasing force. The last bound sent me spinning through the air in a leap of 50 or 60 feet from one side of the gully to the other, and I struck the rocks, luckily with the hold of my left side. They caught my clothes for a moment, and I fell back into the snow with motion arrested. My head, fortunately, came the right side up, and a few frantic catches brought me to a halt in the neck of the gully and on the verge of the precipice. Baton, hat, and veil skimmed by and disappeared, and the crash of the rocks, which I'd started, as they fell on the glacier, told how narrow had been the escape from utter destruction. As it was, I fell nearly 200 feet in 7 or 8 bounds. 10 more feet would have taken me in one gigantic leap of 800 feet onto the glacier below. The situation was sufficiently serious. The rocks could not be let go for a moment, and the blood was spurting out of more than 20 cuts. The most serious ones were in my head, and I vainly tried to close them with one hand, while holding on with the other. It was useless. The blood gushed out in blinding jets at each pulsation. At last, in a moment of inspiration, I kicked out a big lump of snow and stuck it as plaster on my head. The idea was a happy one, and the flow of blood diminished. Then, scrambling up, I got, not a moment too soon, to a place of safety and fainted away. The sun was setting when consciousness returned, and it was pitch dark before the great staircase was descended. But by a combination of luck and care, the whole 4,700 feet of descent to Ryle was accomplished, without a slip or once missing the way. His wounds kept him abed some days. Then he got up and climbed that mountain again. That is the way with a true Alp climber. The more fun he has, the more he wants.